Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Today we feature some conversations about police reform. And since reforms are to a great extent being driven by protests, we'll hear as well from a protester, one who is facing felony charges and up to life in prison for her actions at a demonstration last month. First up, though, it's Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, who on Monday announced policy changes for policing in Utah's capital city. Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, thanks for making time to speak with us once again.
Happy to be with you.
Well, today I want to focus on your executive order making changes to a number of policies inside the Salt Lake City Police Department. The background, though, to your executive order and the changes you're making is, of course, the overall movement for police reform and the nationwide conversation about police brutality, as well as local protests. And just on that point, before we turn to your executive order, there's something that occurred since I requested this interview that I have to ask about first, and that is that on Tuesday, we learned that more protesters involved in a demonstration in front of the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office are being charged with felonies. Two are facing first-degree felony criminal mischief charges that include a gang enhancement, and that means that they could face up to life in prison. These are charges that are brought by Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, though he says he'll have another prosecutor handle the case because the charges involve, you know, his building, his office. Mayor Mendenhall, I know you're not responsible for charging people, but this happened in your city. Do you agree with these charges for these protesters?
I read about the charges filed against the demonstrators. I think, again, it's important to clarify that a mayor doesn't have any role in who gets arrested or who gets charged or what charges are brought. That's not how the criminal justice system works, nor should it be. And if you commit a crime, there ought to be consequences, of course, but the severity of the potential consequences here feels like overkill. A lifetime in prison for buying paint does not feel like justice. Punishment should fit their crimes, but I would respectfully disagree with the severity of these charges.
Yeah, and I would guess that the district attorney is hoping for a plea from protesters. I don't know. I will reach out to him on that. And as you said, the point of civil disobedience is to maybe serve the time. But that common complaint that I'm seeing so far is a potential for life in prison for spilling paint, really. And we will stay with that story. Again, protests nationally and locally have been driving the calls for police reform in the United States. And this week, alongside Police Chief Mike Brown, you signed an executive order that creates various policy changes for the city's police department. I'm hoping that in the limited time we have available, we can just go through some of these changes and hear why each was needed, why you decided to make them. They fall into three categories: police use of force, body cameras, and search and seizure. And I'll just mention that they're required to be in place by September 5th. So with use of force, the brunt of these changes occur there in that category. A big change is the standard under which an officer can use deadly force. And Mayor Mendenhall, the old policy said that an officer had to find it reasonable to believe that a person will use a weapon to harm someone. What does the new policy say?
The new change is that the executive order directs the police to put into place by September 5th. We'll take it beyond that current constitutional floor of Graham versus Connor, which has long required an officer to just use objectively reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. That now raises the floor so that an officer must determine that the deadly force is both necessary and that the threat of death or serious bodily injury is imminent. That necessary and imminent terms are already used in state code and in city policy on use of force, but they haven't been defined. So they will be carefully defined in the new policy. And that's the work that the police department is doing in conjunction with the officers who will be, of course, doing the work out on the streets to make sure that whatever those policy definitions become, that they make both our public more safe and our officers. We're not willing to compromise one over the other. And so it is a balance that we're working to strike in those definitions.
The word necessary seems to indicate a stronger standard than reasonable did. Just before we move on from here, are these standards... I mean, they don't change the law on what a a prosecutor might charge an officer with. I mean, this is policies within the police department that amount to human resources standards, HR standards, or how does that work?
It doesn't change the state statute around what is reasonable, of course, and that is another conversation that we need to be having with our legislature. But you're right, it does affect our Salt Lake City policy, which is what our officers are hired and their employment is based upon adherence to our city's policies and training. So they do, it is very, it's impactful at every level to a Salt Lake City police officer. That's why we have to make sure that we get this right. But I also want to mention that these definitions and this approach to raising the standard around use of force isn't something we're inventing. Our police department has been researching Camden, New Jersey, Austin, Texas, even the FBI's use of force standards. And they've been bringing these best practices into the work that is being proposed today.
I guess a question that I have, and this is probably something yet to be determined, but is, you know, if an officer doesn't follow, if he or she doesn't follow that standard, what is the consequence? Can they be disciplined or even fired for not adhering to that change?
Certainly that's a case-by-case basis that the police department has always and will continue to evaluate as circumstances arise where officers may be found in violation of a policy.
Okay, another change in this use of force category is a requirement that police use de-escalation before they use force. And this just means you have to try to cool things down before using force, and you have to demonstrate that you did that, I guess. Is that correct?
Yeah, de-escalation tactics have been suggested. They've been preferred. With this change, they are mandatory unless it's unreasonable to do so. And there, we recognize that there may be circumstances where that is simply not possible. But officers with this executive order change will be required to employ effective communication strategies to try to de-escalate a situation. We really don't want officers contributing to a situation that could end up leading to the use of force because they've taken an unnecessarily or an overly aggressive stance in that confrontation with an individual.
This may sound naive, but was that not a requirement before? I mean, they were trained in de-escalation, but it wasn't, required. Is that correct?
Suggested and preferred.
Okay. Police were on occasion criticized for using force against a person who was going to harm themselves, meaning just themselves and nobody else. The new policy says that's not allowed anymore.
That's right. And this wasn't one that I was keenly aware of. And in our policy review, it came up and it seems like such an obvious thing, but the use of deadly force will now be prohibited when an officer may be trying to prevent an individual from self-harming, killing themselves, where that individual isn't an imminent threat to anyone else.
I'm just going through the list here, Mayor Mendenhall. Another change on use of force, a duty to intercede if you're an officer and you see one of your colleagues engaging in improper use of force. That was kind of already a part of the police manual, wasn't it?
Yeah. So before, the officers needed to witness an officer inappropriately using force or acting outside of policy in order to be able to step in. They call it a code 909. And it's a way for officers in Salt Lake City Police Department to be able to tap each other out without having to say, you are completely out of line right now. They can just say, 909, I've got this. And that means I'm stepping in because you're out of line, basically. Now it's not wait until they are acting that way. But if an officer reasonably believes that another officer is about to use of force action that's illegal or excessive or inappropriate, then they must intercede. So this is a raising of that floor, as we see with the use of force policy, in an effort to make sure that officers are preventing that from happening for everyone's sake.
And again, just for clarity, what happens if an officer doesn't intercede when they see improper use of force, Mayor Mendenhall?
At case by case, there's an internal review, and anything that involves discipline is part of our memorandum of understanding contract with the Salt Lake City Police Association Union. And so some of these, including probably the one we're going to talk about next, which would be a disabling of body cameras, where we are specifically talking about discipline, comes up in negotiations and consideration over the next 30 days with our police union.
And you need them to sign off on the changes before they can go into effect?
Actually, they have the opportunity to respond, to give us feedback, and there is not a contractual signing off of the policy changes, but we are committed to working with them over the next 30 days. We want this to be a good policy for our officers and for the public. And we recognize that in order to do that, we need feedback from our officers to make sure we get this right.
As you mentioned, a change on body camera policy. I think I'll just have you tell us what this does.
Yeah, our body-worn camera policy has to follow the minimums that are in state code, but we are going to go beyond that now to explicitly allow for discipline of officers who intentionally or if they negligently fail to activate their cameras. And because it involves that disciplinary action, again, we're going to go through our MOU with the police department as it requires us to vet those changes with them over the next 30 days. We want to see if this is an accidental turnoff of the body camera. Was it intentional? Is there a pattern of accidental turnoffs? And we need there to be some consequences and clarity, transparency, both for the officers and the public about what happens and make sure that the police department is taking it seriously and tracking those incidents when body cameras are disabled.
Yeah, and I guess determining intentionality there might be the crux and how you do that.
Certainly.
Before we wrap up here, Mayor Mendenhall, some policy changes on search and seizure. Can you also just describe those changes for us?
Yeah, today, if an officer is going to conduct a search, whether it's real property or a vehicle, and they're going to do so without a warrant, they are required to inform the person being searched of their right to refuse. We want to make this much more clear for the public who are find themselves in those circumstances. This new directive will require the officers to obtain the signature of the person consenting to the search through the Salt Lake City Police Department consent to search form. We're also going to update that form, make it easier to understand, and we'll be translating it into the languages that are most commonly spoken in Salt Lake City.
Okay. You know, just because I know we've got 1 minute left, I just want to quickly ask, you mentioned the changes needed at the state level. Are changes to laws on use of force, is that something that you will be advocating for at the legislature?
Yes, and we have our city attorney's office reviewing that cadre of potential legislative changes. We are preparing to work with our legislature and the state leadership to see that things aren't just improved in the Salt Lake City Police Department, but that we can make improvements in police reform across the state.
Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, thank you very much for your time today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Now on the show, we're going to keep the focus on police reform, but we'll make our way over to Cottonwood Heights, where, as you may have heard, there have been protests going on as well over police use of force. And there has been a fair amount of public criticism over how the police handled one recent protest in particular. KCPW producer Tim Pierce picks up the story from there.
So, you know, you were at the protest in Cottonwood Heights, right? But can you just describe to me sort of what happened during that demonstration and what escalated afterwards in your own words?
I was invited to attend by Tiffany James, who is a constituent of mine, lives in my district. And 2 years ago, her teenager was killed in an officer-involved shooting. There's a group, a local group, called Dance Dance for Revolution. They contacted Tiffany and said, hey, in honor of your son, we would like to do this March for Justice, is what they called it. And what we do is come out to your neighborhood, start in a park, we bring a truck, we play music, happy, upbeat music, we do a little march, go back to the park. They started out, it was very upbeat. They had good messaging. They had guest speakers that shared the value of voting.
This is what democracy looks like.
When we started the walk, they pulled out of the park and started down the street. And it was hot last Sunday. It was probably 104 degrees out. And they had a super soaker on the back of the truck. They were spritzing the crowd with water to keep everybody cool. Very upbeat. It was kind of a dance walk behind the truck. Three or four houses down, we were met by three police vehicles that rushed up and blocked the road. The organizers were having a back and forth conversation with the officers.
Do a favor for me, look. No, look behind you, no. Look. There is room right there. I'm not going to do you a favor. I'm gonna do my Second Amendment right and my First Amendment right by walking in the street because there's too many people for us to be on the sidewalk.
About the legality, could we or could we not occupy street space?
If we have more people than can be on the sidewalk, we can legally be in the street.
That's the law.
You're right. It is the law.
There's too many of us. You're
right.
On the sidewalk.
You're
so
right.
We're
that is the law. But look, all of this sidewalk can be occupied.
Yeah, there's too many of us to occupy the sidewalk safely.
Okay.
So we're
going to
stay in the street.
You cannot.
Yes, we can.
You're all going to be arrested and cited.
No, we're not. It's illegal.
After a lot of discussion, they allowed the group to go forward with them making their best effort to stay on the sidewalk. They turned north onto a street, 6710 South, and started to proceed west, at which time they kettled the crowd. That's when they bring vehicles from the front and from the back.
We were fine till y'all showed up!
Oh my God, you're handing out the baton? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Someone sprayed the super soaker, which water fell on one or two officers. I'm not sure, but that was the time when they decided to start taking people down.
Get back.
Yes, you do.
Well, why do I have to get back? Because you're taking someone over a water bottle?
You guys,
you
can
get people
back. I just got back.
Oh my God, what is wrong with you guys?
I can't
see. So you were part of this protest, and you know, you've been part of other protests. What are you and your fellow demonstrators like? What do you want to see changed, right?
I am an advocate for police reform. There's been a lot of miscommunication or mischaracterization that I'm anti-police, that I want to abolish police, that I want to defund police. None of that is true. What I want to see is, number one, an end to qualified immunity. We've allowed our laws to progress so far that it emboldens certain cops to feel that they are judge, jury, and executor on the spot.
So Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall earlier this week announced an executive order to say that like police have to use de-escalation tactics first before, you know, resorting to more aggressive tactics. Do you think reform like that is enough? Is shifting around these parameters really going to solve the problems that you bore witness to yourself?
It's a great first step because there's a lot of power in words. So when your ordinance reads, you know, officers should exercise de-escalation before resulting in violence, and you change that to officers must exercise de-escalation before moving to violence, it's actually very significant when it comes to a court of law, when it comes to accountability.
You yourself you're put into this unique position because, you know, you witnessed what you did, recorded, shared online, and this stuff spread. But, you know, you're also a local leader, a city councilwoman, right?
Right.
So for you, where is that avenue for change? How do you work to introduce these police reforms within your jurisdiction or your ability, right?
Cottonwood Heights as a city, we are currently in ongoing discussions regarding what kind of ordinance changes we want to make, what kind of new regulations that we want to have. So those conversations are happening right now. And really, really valuable to the council is if people, the public, will engage in these conversations. And we have that format available via Zoom. So anyone can go on to the city website and pre-register to join the Zoom, and then they're allotted 3 minutes to give their public comment. during Zoom, and their Zoom ID will show, but it doesn't show their face. And they get 3 minutes. And really, this is how democracy works. If people will step up and engage and share their ideas, it really goes a long way to have the public's input. And this is true for the current conversation that we're having, or land use issues, or, you know, hey, I want to log in and talk about getting a dog park in my neighborhood. If people engage, it's how democracy works.
Cottonwood Heights City Councilwoman Telly Bruce, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to speak with me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, that was KCPW producer Tim Pierce in conversation with Cottonwood Heights City Councilwoman Tally Bruce about protests in that city for police reform. A quick note here that Cottonwood Heights Police Chief Robbie Russo is suing the city, alleging there's a conspiracy to get him removed from his post. Councilwoman Bruce is named in that lawsuit. We asked her about Chief Russo's claims, but she told us she was unable to comment because it is ongoing litigation. Now on the show, we're going to hear from one of the protesters facing felony charges for her alleged actions at a demonstration here in Salt Lake City last month. At the beginning of the show, Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall said she disagreed with the severity of the charges brought by Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill against Madalena McNeil. Charging documents allege that McNeil bought red paint at a Home Depot, paint that was later spread on the street and on the walls of the DA's building. Those documents also accuse her of shouting to incite other protesters and of balling up her fists and appearing to shift her weight as though she was going to slam into an officer, a charge she later comically described on Twitter as felony YIATA. I spoke with McNeil yesterday and asked her to first remind us why she was protesting.
Yeah, so the charges that you're referring to are for alleged actions that took place on the day, I believe it was July 9th, the day that the ruling came down in the shooting of Bernardo Palacios Carvajal, who was killed by Salt Lake City Police in May 2020. It was found that there was no wrongdoing on the part of the police, and actually the district attorney Sim Gill praised the behavior of the police officers who shot Bernardo in the back, emptied their clips. I think it was 34 rounds that were shot at him. So there had been protests going for a while as part of the national movement against police brutality and for police reform and accountability. And on the day that the ruling came down, people were understandably upset and wanted to express their unhappiness with the fact that there was clearly going to be no legal justice, at least not through the district attorney's office. So I was at that protest to support, but also as part of an effort that I do with other community volunteers and organizers to provide water, masks, hand sanitizer, and snacks to protesters to try and slow the spread of COVID-19.
And again, we'll leave aside the specific allegations because I know that that's something you can't talk about. But I guess a question that I have, Madalena, is do you, in the sort of broad sense, consider yourself a civil disobedient, meaning was getting arrested, if not part of the plan, then at least something you were willing to face?
So I think that the thing about these particular charges, as you mentioned, I'm facing a first degree felony and a third degree felony, and the first degree has a gang enhancement, making it punishable potentially by life in prison. I think the thing that is pretty disturbing about this particularly is that if you read, you know, the reporting on what I have been accused of doing, it really comes down to yelling, shifting my weight, and buying paint. Those are the allegations. So I think that really the question here is that civil disobedience? You know, are we at the point as a country where we don't have rights to be able to gather and protest? And we, even if we in theory have those rights, the punishment that someone would face for allegedly doing something as simple as buying paint from the store or yelling at a police officer would be the same as the punishment for rape or murder. I think that's really the question that I'm asking and that I want everyone to be asking themselves is, why are protesters who are largely peaceful, if you see the protests in Salt Lake City, they've been by and large extremely peaceful, and the damage has been able to be taken care of, any damage that occurred to buildings or streets, why are protesters now facing life in prison for something that's supposed to be a constitutionally protected right.
Why engage in defacing property to make your point? And you don't have to comment on, you know, the yes or no of you specifically, but, you know, maybe generally or theoretically, why engage in that kind of an activity?
I think this is really interesting to me because I think that often when we ask that question, we forget that protests that involve property damage are always in response to something. It's not just that people went out one day and decided to damage property. It's not, it's always in response to a greater injustice. And I think that that's what I would really like to, you know, the conversation to come back around to is that is property damage really a worse offense than taking a human life? And is it really a disproportionate response? And why do we feel that it might be? So I think that's something that's been very troubling to me throughout this whole thing is, and I think that there have honestly been people in the city who have been, you know, city officials who have said, yeah, like, you know what, people are upset. Let's let this happen. Let's let people get it out. Because I think this happened even in one of the earlier protests. You know, the city's position was we value human life more than property. And so we can clean it up. We can replace things. A building windows can be replaced. A human life can't. So I think it's almost a different question of, you know, sure, why are we defacing, or why are people in the country defacing property? Sure, but also why do we have such a problem with it and we're ignoring the fact that it's in response to something much worse?
There's been, you know, a fair amount of condemnation of these charges from the mayor, for example, earlier on the show. I know you can't talk about the charges themselves. I guess, you know, what can you say about them? Are you able to describe why you think they are as severe as they are and why they're being brought against you? Is that something you can talk about?
So I can't discuss the specifics of the case. I can say that I think generally I am just one example in a pattern of retribution against protesters that is taking place from the district attorney's office at the federal level. And that is really, we've seen it happening and it's continuing to escalate. And I think that I'm just one example. I do feel that this is an effort to make a point and to put a chilling effect on the protests, to kind of say, you know what, if you are so much as near the area, we can accuse you of things and we can put a first degree felony charge on you and that will ruin your life. And so I think that's the only sense I can make of it, because I can't understand any other reason for such extreme charges, for such allegedly, like, they're low level alleged offenses. And I think it really is designed to send a message to protesters that don't do this, because we have more power than you do. And I think that's part of why protesting against injustice is so important.
Again, that's Madalena McNeil, who is facing first-degree felony criminal mischief charges with a gang enhancement. That means a potential punishment of up to life in prison for her actions during a protest at the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office last month. I reached out to the DA's office for comment on the critique from the mayor and from others about the severity of the charges Madalena and other protesters are facing. We weren't able to connect in time for this show, but we've scheduled a conversation about that for early next week. That's all the time we've got for on the show today. This has been In the Hive here on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening.